I was giving some preliminary information concerning what we see in the sky, and I pointed out that the what is called the Jyotish Shastra, including works such as the Surya Siddhanta, provide a numerical description of what we actually see going on in the sky in terms of the motion of the sun, the moon, the planets, and so forth. So this Jyotisha Shastra describes the universe as we see it with our ordinary sense perception. So now today, what I will do is describe how the universe is presented in the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now here, we're going to be going beyond the limits of our normal senses. So just to give an indication of that, I should point out that this is quite explicitly indicated in the Srimad Bhagavatam itself. So the beginning of the description of the universe in Srimad Bhagavatam starts with the following statement by Shukadeva Goswami. Actually, Maharaj Parikshit has just asked Shukadeva Goswami to describe the universe. So Shukadeva Goswami said, "My dear king, there is no limit to the expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's material energy. This material world is a transformation of the material qualities, sattva-guna, rajoguna, and tamoguna. Yet no one could possibly explain it perfectly, even in a lifetime as long as that of Brahma. No one in the material world is perfect, and an imperfect person could not describe this material universe accurately, even after continued speculation. O king, I shall nevertheless try to explain to you the principal regions, such as Bhugolaka, with their names, forms, measurements, and various symptoms." So Shukadeva Goswami begins by making the point that it's not possible to give a complete description of the material universe. Actually, the objective of modern scientific research in the area of cosmology is at least in one sense to give a complete description. Of course, the scientists do not imagine that they're going to be able to describe exactly what each atom in the universe is doing. That would obviously be impossible. But their idea is to formulate a complete model in which all of the basic elements that appear in the universe have a representation. And their idea is that whatever is in the universe will be in their model, represented in mathematical form, so that they have a full understanding of all the different categories of phenomena that are going on. This is the goal in modern cosmology. So one can take it, though, from this statement by Shukadeva Goswami, or at least one way to look at it, is that it would be very difficult for us to do that. So we can expect that there might actually be aspects of the material universe which we could not hope to properly describe or define using a model that we can visualize within our minds. So we should always be open to that possibility. So with that in mind, what I will do is briefly summarize the description of the universe given by Shukadeva Goswami. This description begins, naturally, with a discussion of what is called Bhumandala. Now, I mentioned yesterday that when the Srimad Bhagavatam refers to the earth, it is referring to this Bhumandala. And Bhumandala can be essentially imagined as a disk about 4 billion miles in diameter. So the description given by Shukadeva Goswami begins with a discussion of this Bhumandala. Now, the first thing to notice about Bhumandala is that the scale of Bhumandala essentially corresponds to the scale of the solar system. That is, in terms of order of magnitude, or rough ballpark figures, The size of Bhumandala is about the size of the solar system. A radius of 2 billion miles takes you out to about twice the orbit of Saturn, just to give an idea of the size of this. So Bhumandala, however, is described as a variegated world with various geographical features. There are mountains, oceans, different kinds of plant and animal life, human beings, and so on, various kinds of inhabitants. All of these features are there. However, when you read the description of Bhumandala, the first thing that becomes apparent is that the scale of size of all the different geographical features is very large. The different, just as Bhumandala itself is very large, being about 4 billion miles across, so also the mountains and oceans and so on the surface of Bhumandala have a corresponding size. So I've referred to this as celestial geography, because it is not like the geography that we're acquainted with here on the Earth. So to give an idea of what is involved with Bhumandala, I'll start by describing what is known as Jambudvip. Bhumandala is essentially structured in the form of a series of expanding rings, which are concentric with one another. And in the center of this series of rings, which you can roughly visualize as being like a bullseye used in archery practice. So in the center of this series of rings, there's a circular region called Bhumandala, called Jambudvip. So Jambudvip is also a disk or a circle, and it's described that Jambudvip is 100,000 yojanas in diameter. So maybe I should stop briefly here to say something about a yojana, because that term is always used in the Bhagavatam. You can find various definitions of the yojana, which will clarify the nature of this unit of distance. Srila Prabhupada uses 8 miles to the yojana. Well, there are different definitions. One definition of the yojana is that a yojana is 4 kroshas, and a krosha means a shout. And what this literally means is a krosha is the distance that a person with good hearing can hear the shout of a person with good lung power. So that is 1 krosha. I presume it means under appropriate weather conditions. That is, the person doesn't have to shout against a headwind or something like that. So that's the definition of a krosha. So there are 4 kroshas in a yojana. So this is a sort of rough and ready measure. It's also described that there are 800 nri in a yojana, and a nri is the height of a man. So that's another definition. The Bhagavatam commentator Vamsidhar pointed out that the units of distance, which are commonly used, are measured on the basis of the body of the yajamana. Yajamana means a person authorizing a sacrifice. So the idea was that on the basis of the size of that person's body, the various units that might be appropriate in the sacrifice were determined. So it was recognized that these units were variable. So depending on the size of the person, the yojana could be large or small. However, you can see that there's only a limited range of variation because people only have a limited range of sizes. So the yojana was a variable measure. However, in astronomy, it's not really adequate to have a measure that can vary so freely. So different astronomers would fix the yojana in a specific way, but there are different standards of size. It turns out, though, that you can calibrate the yojana in terms of miles by looking at statements concerning the diameter of the Earth. For example, in the writings of Aryabhatta, the diameter of the Earth is given as 1,050 yojanas. And if you compare that with the present figure for the diameter of the Earth, you can find that they're about 7.55 yojanas per mile, miles per yojana. And in the Surya Siddhanta, in Siddhanta Shiromani, the figure for the diameter of the Earth is more like 1,600 yojanas. So there the yojana comes out to about 5 miles. So there are different standards which are used. So the Jambudvip is 100,000 yojanas across, and it's circular in form. So is a view of Jambudvip looking down from above. Jambudvip is intersected by different mountain ranges. So these lines that I've drawn represent ranges of mountains. Yeah, that could help. So you'll notice that there are 3 parallel lines down below, and then another set of 3 lines up above. So these 6 are 6 mountain ranges. Then the 2 vertical lines that I've drawn there are additional mountain ranges. So these mountain ranges divide Jambudvip into a series of regions called varshas. Actually, the word varsha means valley between 2 mountains. So there are, as you can see, 9 varshas in Jambudvip. Now, in the very center, I've drawn a smaller circle, and that represents the location of Mount Meru. So these mountains are quite large. Just to give an idea, the 6 horizontal mountain ranges shown here are each 10,000 yojanas high. So that would come out to 80,000 miles. We'll just use the 8-mile yojana. So this, of course, immediately indicates something. If the Earth of our experience, that is this Earth we can travel around on, is 25,000 miles around the equator, then you can't place on this Earth a mountain 80,000 miles high because it's bigger than the Earth. In fact, the diameter of the Earth is about 8,000 miles, so a mountain 80,000 miles high is about 10 times as big as the Earth. So these mountains have a height about 10 times the diameter of the Earth. Actually, even the smallest mountains described in Jambudvip have a height about twice the diameter of the Earth. So this gives an idea of the scale of size of Jambudvip. Now, even though these different geographical features of Jambudvip are on a much larger scale than the geography that we know of, there is a correspondence between Jambudvip and the regions that we experience on this Earth planet. And that will be a subject that maybe I'll get into in more detail tomorrow. But for now, I'll mainly give a description just of Jambudvip as it's presented in the Bhagavatam. So these different varshas all have different names. The southernmost varsha is called Bharata Varsha, which gives an indication of the connection between Jambudvip and this world of our experience, because here, yeah. If I had a pointer, actually, that would be good. But
this is it right here.
Yeah. That semicircle down there at the bottom is Bharat Varsha. So, then, there are various names for the different varshas, Ketumala Varsha, Bhadrashva Varsha, Ilavriti Varsha, and so on. They all have different names. That's one. Right, those are the nine varshas. So, and then in the very north, it's Uttara Kuru Varsha, and so on. So, this is Jambudweep, as seen from above.
Okay, good.
A pointer. So, the Bhagavatam gives a description of the inhabitants of Jambudweep. This description is quite significant. In all of the eight varshas other than Bharata Varsha, the conditions are celestial. That is, these are heavenly regions. In fact, it's described in the Bhagavatam that the human beings in Bharata Varsha can acquire karma through their actions, whereas the human beings in the other varshas are not acquiring karma, but they're merely exhausting the results of pious activities. It's described that if you perform various pious activities within this life, it is possible to be elevated to what is called Svarga Loka. Now, Svarga Loka is completely beyond this Bhumandala region, and I'll be saying something about what Svarga Loka is later on also. Svarga Loka is the realm of the demigods proper, being such as Indra and so forth. So when one is elevated to this Svarga Loka, one can have an exceedingly long lifespan of many millions of years. But and typically, a person in that Svarga Loka will tend to engage in material activities and enjoy the results of the good karma that they have accumulated. So what happens is, after a certain period of time, which will be very long by our standards, a person in the Svarga Loka will have exhausted the karmic credits which entitle them to live within that realm, and so then they're forced to transmigrate down to the earthly realm of existence. However, the earth in question is this Mandala. And in particular, souls that fall down from the Svarga Loka can take birth in the eight varshas of Jambudweep other than Bharat Varsha. And there they again have bodies similar to those of demigods. However, their lifespan is shorter. It amounts to thousands of years instead of millions of years. So they're in the process of descending in terms of karmic merit. So, however, they are not building up more karma. They're just exhausting the results of their previous pious activities. So there are many descriptions in the Bhagavatam of what life is like in these other varshas of Jambudweep. It is described that, first of all, even the ordinary inhabitants live for thousands of years, and they enjoy very utopian circumstances. They have very opulent lives and so forth. They don't suffer from disease and old age and so on. Also, the various demigods frequently visit these different parts of Bharat Varsha. So in the stories in the Mahabharata and the Bhagavatam, you'll always find references to Lord Shiva and Indra and so on engaging in activities in these different varshas. So these are definitely celestial regions. So this is significant because, in terms of dimensions, you can, just by a simple calculation, conclude that most of Bharat Varsha is many thousands of miles away from the earth that we know. I mean, most of Jambudweep, simply because of the size. If it is 800,000 miles across, then most of it is, let's say, more than 10,000 miles away from us. So most of it is located then in what we would regard as outer space. So that's the first conclusion that one can come to simply by considering the dimensions. So this is the Bharatvarsha. I'll give you an idea of the vertical relief in Bharatvarsha also. Here what I did was, here we're looking at Jambudweep from an angle now. So the circular disk of Jambudweep now becomes an ellipse, which is foreshortened. That's what the drawing is supposed to represent. And you see this inverted cone extending up to a height which is nearly equal to the diameter of Jambudweep itself. Now this is what is known as Mount Meru, which is the most prominent feature of Jambudweep. So Mount Meru is described as being 84,000 yojanas high. So the diameter of Jambudweep is 100,000 yojanas. So you can see it's nearly as high as Jambudweep is wide. So that description is given. It is also said that at the top, Mount Meru is 32,000 yojanas across, and at the base, it's 16,000 yojanas across. So it gets wider as you go to the top. That's the description. Yeah, the top is twice as wide as the base. Yeah, it's flat on the top, and it is described that on the top there is the a city of Lord Brahma. This is not Satyaloka, that's a different place, but Brahma has a residence on top of this Mount Meru, and also the eight principal demigods called Dikpalas have residences up on the top of the mountain. So, yeah, this is Mount Meru going up. So, somewhat crude drawing. Actually, you can take a look later, but I have some computer-generated drawings of Jambudweep here. Actually, I don't know if anyone can see this very clearly, but this you can look at later. It gives a clear idea. Also, this plain of Jambudweep here is exceedingly mountainous. As I was saying, the mountains there are about 80,000 miles high. But that makes them about a tenth as high as the total height of Mount Meru, which is 84,000 yojanas. So that gives you an idea of the scale of Jambudweep. So Jambudweep is the central hub of this Bhumandala. And compared with Bhumandala as a whole, this Jambudweep is actually very small. So I'll make another drawing to indicate what the rest of Bhumandala looks like. What we'll do is, I'll explain this obscure-looking diagram. What I've done there, the very small inner circle there represents Jambudvip. So surrounding Jambudvip, there is a ring-shaped ocean. And the width of that ocean is equal to the diameter of Jambudvip itself. And then surrounding that ocean, there's a ring-shaped island called Plakshadvip. And its width is also equal to the width of the ocean, which is equal to the width of Jambudvip. Surrounding that, there is another ring-shaped ocean. But its width is twice the width of Plakshadvip. And then, going still further, there's a ring-shaped island surrounding that, which is of equal width. And then another ring-shaped ocean, which is twice the width of that island. And another ring-shaped island, which is equal to the width of that ocean, and so on. So in total, counting Jambudvip as the center, there are seven islands and seven oceans. And these form a series of concentric expanding rings on the surface of this Bhumandala. So that's what the geographical layout of Bhumandala is like. Now, the seventh of these islands going out is called Pushkaradvip. And it is described that in the center of Pushkaradvip going out, there is a ring-shaped mountain that goes all the way around in a circle. And that's called Manasotara Mountain. So also various other mountains, rivers, and other geographical features of these islands are described. There's quite a detailed description. So this is a basic idea of what Jambudvip looks like as described in the Bhagavatam. So let's see here. Looking for something. Okay. Excuse me? Well, what you have is going out, there's a series of alternating oceans and ring-shaped islands. Yeah, it's all part of one plate, as it were, or disk. This is the basic description that is given. So this is the description. Now, naturally, one would like to ask, well, what does this correspond to in terms of experience or in the reality that we can perceive with our senses? Well, it turns out that one can get some insight into that. And to do that, we have to consider the relation between the sun and this disk called Bhumandala. So that's the next topic to discuss. So as I was saying, when you go out to this seventh island, there's this ring-shaped mountain. Now, this mountain essentially is the track of the sun's orbit. That is described in the Bhagavatam. So just to give an indication of this, in this verse in the fifth canto, we read that in the middle of that island is a great mountain named Manasotara, which forms the boundary between the inner side and the outer side of the island. Its breadth and height are 10,000 yojanas. On that mountain, in the four directions, are the residential quarters of demigods such as Indra. In the chariot of the sun god, the sun travels on top of the mountain in an orbit called Samvatsara, encircling Mount Meru. The sun's path on the northern side is called Uttarayana, and its path on the southern side is called Dakshinayana. One side represents a day for the demigods, and the other represents their night. So this description is given. So what's being described here is one can imagine in this outermost ring-shaped island a mountain which essentially is like a circular track that goes all the way around. It has a radius which, if you calculate on the basis of the dimensions given here, turns out to be about 126 million miles. Now that's using 8 miles per yojana. So the idea is that the sun is traveling, and it's described that the sun is traveling on a chariot on top of this ring-shaped mountain, and it's going around in circles. And as we read here, in the center is Jambudvip with Mount Meru. So therefore, the sun is going around Mount Meru. And it is stated here that on the northern side of Mount Meru, and what we do is we have directions. You assign north, south, east, and west. So on the northern side of Mount Meru, that is called the Uttarayana path of the sun. And on the southern side, it is called the Dakshinayana path. So what this indicates is that the sun will go around in a time period of 1 year on this track, spending 1 year to the north and one half of the year to the north and one half to the south. And this represents the day and night of the demigods. It's described in the Bhagavatam that the day and night of the demigods corresponds to a full year by human calculation. So that's the basic description. Now, as I said, it's described that the sun travels on top of Mount Meru, on top of Mount Manasotara in a chariot. Here's a description of that chariot. It says here, the chariot of the sun god has only one wheel, which is known as Samvatsara. The 12 months are calculated to be its 12 spokes. The 6 seasons are the sections of its rim, and the 3 Chaturmasya periods are its 3-sectioned hub. On one side of the axle carrying the wheel, rests upon the summit of Mount Sumeru, and the other rests upon Manasotara Mountain. Affixed to the outer end of the axle, the wheel continually rotates on Manasotara Mountain like the wheel of an oil pressing machine. So there's a simple imagery being given here to describe the motion of the sun. I take it that by an oil pressing machine, what is meant here is you have a heavy wheel which is hooked to an axle that goes to a central post, and then oxen would pull this wheel around in a circle, and you could put things underneath the wheel and they would crush it as they moved over it to extract oil or something like that. So that's the basic description. So it's described then that the sun is moving around this mountain, on top of this mountain. Now, the height of the mountain is given as 10,000 yojanas, or 80,000 miles. And in fact, elsewhere you can find an indication that the height of the sun above the surface of Bhumandala is 100,000 yojanas. That's the figure which is given. So what this description means then is that the sun is moving in a circular path around the surface of Bhumandala, and its height above Bhumandala is 100,000 yojanas. Now, the radius of the circle is 126 million miles. So if the height above Bhumandala is 800,000 miles, and the radius is 126 million miles, what that means is that the radius is quite a bit larger than the height above the surface. And this is a very significant thing to consider, because imagine that you're standing on a flat plain, and at a distance from you, say 126 yards, there is a light moving on a wheeled vehicle of some kind, maybe a chariot, which is held 8 yards above the plane, but it's 126 yards out from you, and it's going around in a circle. So in that case, what will you see? Well, what you would see is that the light will be practically horizontal from your point of view, and it will be moving around in a circle, going around and coming back and so on. So that is the what that indicates then is that if you visualize this Bhu Mandala as a plane and imagine yourself standing in the center of the plane at a point on this Jambudvip, then, and imagine that the plane provides your own horizon, that is, you're standing perpendicular to that plane, then the motion of the sun that you would perceive would be that the sun is going around horizontally, moving around in a circle continuously. So that's how it would look according to this description. So that is the description given in the Bhagavatam of the motion of the sun. Now, as I indicated previously, yesterday, the sun has two types of motion. There's the rightward motion, which takes one day to complete, and the leftward motion, which takes one year to complete. Now, I've already suggested that the motion of the sun on Bhu Mandala can be thought of as taking one year, but there's also the rightward motion that takes one day, and we have to consider that also. So at this point, one can ask, well, all right, how does this description relate to experience? An immediate impression that some people might get on reading this is that the Bhagavatam is presenting a very naive, flat earth model of the universe. So one can consider that idea. However, if that is so, then you run into a problem. The idea behind what you could call a naive flat earth interpretation of this description is that the plane of Bhu Mandala represents the plane of our local horizon. That is, the earth looks flat to us locally, especially if we're in a flat area like the plain states or something like that. And we can imagine it extending in all directions as a plane. Now, if you imagine the earth as a globe, the plane of the local horizon is a plane tangent to the globe at the point where we're standing. So interpreting this as a naive flat earth model, you have the idea that, well, the earth really isn't a globe. The plane of our local horizon really is the plane of the earth, and it extends out in all directions for a very long distance. However, given the description of the motion of the sun in the Bhagavatam, one would have to conclude then that we should see the sun always clinging to the horizon and never going above it. Now, in fact, on the earth, there are places in which you can see something like that. If you go north of the Arctic Circle, at the right time of year, you will, in fact, see the sun skimming around the horizon, forming a complete circle once per day. So there are places where you can experience that. But in latitudes below the Arctic Circle, of course, that cannot be experienced, and it certainly cannot be experienced in India. Actually, there was one person named Tilak who used this argument this idea to argue that the original Vedic Aryans must have lived in the Arctic region. He thought they must have lived up in the area of the Laplanders in northern Scandinavia and then migrated down and finally moved into India. And actually, Hitler took advantage of this idea by suggesting that the Germanic people simply hadn't gone that far from their original Arctic region in the northern part of Scandinavia. So anyway, these are speculative theories. So what I was indicating yesterday, though, about the Jyotish Shastra would strongly suggest that the Bhagavatam could not be presenting a naive flat earth model. because in fact the Jyotish Shastra describes the earth as a globe, and it provides a very sophisticated description of latitude and longitude. There are methods for calculating, for example, your latitude and longitude by making observations of the planets and the moon and so forth. So the idea of the earth as a globe was definitely well known according to the Vedic tradition. So how then can one understand this description of the Bhumandala? Well, one way to try to understand that is to look at the description of the motion of the sun and assume that the Bhagavatam is actually making sense in terms of what we see. So if that is true, then the sun must always be close to Bhumandala, because the sun is moving in a chariot around Bhumandala, and it is very close to Bhumandala compared to how far it is from us. So that means if you look at where the sun is in the sky, that will tell you where Bhumandala is. So this indicates then that Bhumandala corresponds to a plane tilted in the sky with respect to our local horizon, simply because the sun moves up in the sky with respect to our local horizon. So if the sun is always close to Bhumandala and the sun is moving up in the sky, that means that must be where Bhumandala is. If you try and interpret the statement in the Bhagavatam as making sense in terms of what we can observe. So, in fact, there are many different verses in the Bhagavatam which confirm the basic idea that Bhumandala does correspond to a plane associated with the motion of the sun in the sky. Now, I'm not going to try to go through all the reasoning in detail. I'll just sum up what, as far as I can see, is the basic conclusion that one arrives at. Yesterday, I was describing what I call the circle of the ecliptic, which corresponds to the yearly motion of the sun through the celestial sphere. So, as I was saying, there are two motions of the sun. One motion is due to what in Sanskrit is called the Kala Chakra. This corresponds to the rotation of the celestial sphere as a whole. So this rotation occurs along the axis going through the pole star. And as I said, the whole sphere can be thought of as rotating in a clockwise direction, and all the stars are moving around. But the stars don't move relative to one another. It's as though they are painted on the surface of the sphere, and the whole sphere is rotating. So then, the sun also is being carried around by this daily rotation. So you can imagine the sun is sitting on this sphere also. But in addition, the sun has a leftward motion which follows this track called the ecliptic. And this track, as I indicated yesterday, is tilted at a 23-degree angle, roughly, to the celestial equator, which represents the direction of motion, of rotation of this celestial sphere. So that's a brief description of what I was indicating yesterday about the motion of the sun. Well, the description of the Bhumandala and the motion of the sun can be consistently understood if one takes Bhumandala to correspond to the plane of the ecliptic. So if one takes it in that way, then one can think of this plane of Bhumandala as passing through space along what to us is the path of the ecliptic. So every day this whole plane rotates. The sun is situated on that plane, and so there's a daily rotation of the sun. But the sun is moving in its chariot on this track on the Manasotara mountain, taking 1 year to go around. And as it goes around, that corresponds to the yearly motion of the sun through the ecliptic in a complete circle.
You're saying the whole track is also
Yeah, the track also has to rotate. Yeah, so the sun has two motions, one due to the rotation of the whole thing, and the other due to its motion in this plane. So this particular interpretation is, as I was seeing recently, is borne out by this Bhagavatam commentator, Vamsidhar, who identifies this plane of Bhumandala with the what he calls Nakshatra Kaksha. Briefly, Nakshatra Kaksha is the Sanskrit term for the ecliptic. The meaning here, Kaksha means a circular orbit, or anything circular, basically. There are 27 nakshatras in Vedic astronomy. These are, well, they're two different things. A nakshatra, on the one hand, is a constellation of stars, and on the other hand, it's a corresponding division of the ecliptic. So there are 27 equal divisions of the ecliptic, each of which is 13 and a third degrees going around. So the circle of the nakshatras, or the nakshatra kaksha. Bhumandala. The idea is then that in addition to this earth globe of our experience, in which we have small geographical features, there's this larger earth which extends for billions of miles out into space, essentially in what corresponds in modern thinking to the plane of the solar system. And on this earth plane, the sun is moving in its orbit. So, of course, when you look out in the sky at night, you don't see any such thing. That is, we don't see any arrangement of gigantic mountains and so forth out in the sky in that region. However, the indication then in the Bhagavatam is that there are many things that we don't see. Now, tomorrow, I'll go into more of a description of how it can be that things are there that we don't see and so forth. That's a whole subject to go into. But here I'm just trying to give an outline of the basic cosmological description in the Bhagavatam. So the basic point then here is that in addition to this world that we know of the earth, there is a celestial domain which is extending out into space. And the direction in which that domain is located corresponds to the path of the sun. So, at this point, I guess I'll go to one further topic, and then we can stop and consider different questions and so forth. So, that is the question of the motion of the planets. Oh, actually, before I get to that, there are a couple of verses in the Bhagavatam that shed some more light on this. I've described how the sun has two types of motion. So Maharaj Parikshit also found this to be a little bit bewildering, it would seem. And so he asked Sukadeva Goswami about it. So there's a verse here in which King Parikshit inquired from Shukadeva Goswami, "My dear Lord, you have already affirmed the truth that the supremely powerful sun god travels around Dhruvaloka with both Dhruvaloka and Mount Sumeru on his right. Yet at the same time, the sun god faces the signs of the zodiac and keeps Sumeru and Dhruvaloka on his left. How can we reasonably accept that the sun god proceeds with Sumeru and Dhruvaloka on both his left and his right simultaneously?" So Parikshit asks this question. So the reason for the question is that in the previous verses here, the rightward daily motion of the sun has been described around Mount Meru. By the way, in this verse, Dhruvaloka is mentioned. Dhruvaloka is the pole star. So you can imagine the axis of rotation of the Kala Chakra as being defined by Mount Meru at one end and the pole star at the other. And then you can imagine an axis going between those two. So the daily motion goes around to the right, and the yearly motion goes around to the left. So Maharaj Parikshit is saying, well, how can the sun go to the right and the left at the same time? So Sri Shukadev Goswami answered, when a potter's wheel is moving and small ants located on that big wheel are moving with it, one can see that their motion is different from that of the wheel because they appear sometimes in one part of the wheel and sometimes on another. Similarly, the signs and constellations with Sumeru and Dhruvaloka on their right move with the wheel of time, and the ant-like sun and other planets move with them. The sun and planets, however, are seen in different signs and constellations at different times. This indicates that their motion is different from that of the zodiac and the wheel of time itself. So the idea is we have here a description of relative motion. The sun is moving on this disk, which is described by analogy here as a potter's wheel. And that wheel itself is rotating. So we see the sum total of those two motions to be the motion of the sun. But the sun has its motion with respect to the wheel, and then because of the rotation of the wheel, it has a motion in the opposite direction. So the rotation of the wheel corresponds to the daily motion of the sun, and the yearly motion corresponds to the motion on the wheel. So, okay. The next topic to come to is the description of the planets. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the distances of the planets are described using Bhumandala as the reference. So it's described that the different planets have different heights above Bhumandala. Now this can be a cause of a certain amount of confusion. The planets are being described in terms of how far away they are from this plane of Bhumandala. Their distances from the Earth or from the observer standing on the Earth are not being mentioned. So you can think of two kinds of distance. From Jambudvip or Bharatvarsha or wherever we are, the basic idea is that we're in the center. We're located in the center of this whole system. So when the distances are mentioned in the Bhagavatam, it's natural to think that what is meant is distance along the line of sight from the position of the observer. However, the actual description is that the distance is measured perpendicular to the plane of Bhumandala. So if this is the case, then to understand these differences, one has to have some idea of where Bhumandala is. So if Bhumandala is the plane of the ecliptic, then that means the distances given for the sun, the moon, and so forth in the Bhagavatam represent the distance of these planets from the plane of the ecliptic. Now, in fact, this idea brings the description in the Bhagavatam of the distances of the planets into pretty good qualitative agreement with the distances of the planets as given in modern astronomy. This is just an interesting point to consider. Of course, in the case of the sun, we have two types of distance described in the Bhagavatam, namely the radial distance going out from Jambudvip to this ring-shaped Manasotara mountain, and then the distance perpendicular to the plane of Bhumandala going up to the sun. So, as I said before, the distance going out to the orbit of the sun is 126 million miles, if you express that in miles. That is, interestingly enough, of the same order of magnitude, roughly, as the distance to the sun according to modern astronomy, which is given as 93 million miles. And in fact, if you consider that this assumes you're using 8-mile yojanas, but the yojana can be fairly flexibly defined. So one can say that the Bhagavatam agrees quite nicely with modern astronomy concerning the distance of the sun. Now, in modern astronomy, the distance of the sun from the ecliptic is by definition zero, because the ecliptic is the path of the sun. And in the Bhagavatam, the distance of the sun from the ecliptic is 800,000 miles. So this would indicate that if you try to make sense out of this, that the ecliptic corresponds approximately with Bhumandala. You have an 800,000-mile difference there, which is small compared to 126 million miles. Now, the positions of the moon, Mercury, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn, and so on, are also given in the Bhagavatam. However, only their distances from Bhumandala are given. Their radial distances, as measured going out from Jambudvip, are not mentioned in the Bhagavatam. However, in terms of orders of magnitude, the distances given for the moon, Mars, et cetera, from the plane of Bhumandala are the same as the distances, the maximum distances that the different planets move from the ecliptic, according to modern astronomy. So that basic agreement is there. So this is all more or less consistent with the idea that Bhumandala corresponds to the location of Bhumandala corresponds to the plane of the ecliptic. So to sum up what I've been saying here, the Bhagavatam, in describing the universe, is describing things in terms of a celestial realm. Actually, the word in one other word in Sanskrit which is used for this is Bhauma Svarga. As I mentioned, there's the heavenly planets proper, and that's called Svarga Loka. But Srila Prabhupada points out that everything in Bhumandala, apart from Bharata Varsha, can be called Bhauma Svarga. That means earthly heaven, literally speaking. So the idea is that there is a celestial or heavenly realm extending out from the vicinity of the earth that we know through the plane of the solar system. And that is described in terms of celestial geography, in which there are descriptions of enormous oceans, mountains, different kinds of inhabitants, and so on. And all these different inhabitants are on the level of demigods, or at least what are called upadevas, or semi-demigods. Then there are... yeah, that word is used. So that's the description. And whereas one might tend to immediately think that this must be something mythological that corresponds to a very naive picture of the earth, there are indications that that's not really true at all. But this Bhumandala has a location in space which makes sense in terms of what we observe. So that means then that the description in the Bhagavatam is essentially, on a qualitative level, consistent with our sense experience. It doesn't contradict anything that we can see. However, it does introduce a whole realm of existence that we do not perceive. In other words, what the Bhagavatam is saying about the location of the sun and the planets and so on relative to one another does not really contradict our sensory experience. Of course, the description in the Bhagavatam is not a precise mathematical description, and I would propose that it's not intended to be a precise mathematical description. However, as a qualitative description, it more or less corresponds with what we see, with the addition of this entire realm of celestial geography, which of course we don't see. So the radical statement that the Bhagavatam is really making is that there is a vast world which is inhabited by different kinds of beings and which essentially extends through the plane of the solar system, but which is not detectable by our present senses. So, okay, it's about 10 after 7. There are many further topics to discuss. This is also just the briefest of introductions. So I'll discuss more tomorrow, and you can ask questions. Yeah? Yeah, well, obviously there's a difference between those planets and the structure of Bhumandala, because we see the planets and we don't see Bhumandala. They don't correspond with the Dvipas. They're above Bhumandala. So, and the description is given of the ordinary planets that we know, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, plus the Sun and the Moon, plus two other planets, Rahu and Ketu. Actually, the Bhagavatam doesn't mention Ketu, as far as I'm aware. Other Vedic literatures do, but the Bhagavatam discusses Rahu. But those are definitely the planets that we know. Their years are described, and they correspond to the modern idea of what the years are. For example, it takes Jupiter, which is Brihaspati, 12 years to go around. That's the in agreement with current astronomical ideas and so forth. So these planets in Sanskrit are called grahas. The word graha is used. And as far as I'm aware, nothing else in Vedic cosmology is referred to as a graha. Srila Prabhupada, when he uses the word planet, what he is normally doing is translating the Sanskrit word loka. He typically translates loka as planet. But the what we call the planets, Mars, Mercury, Venus, and so on, are called grahas. And in Sanskrit, actually, graha means to grasp or seize something. And so what this refers to is the idea that the planets have an astrological influence on the affairs of human beings. So the idea is that they grab a hold of you in some sense and exert some kind of influence. So they're somehow special in nature. So I can briefly indicate, by the way, that this plane of Bhumandala that I've been describing is one of 14 different planes that are described in the Vedic description of the universe. This is called the middle planetary system, you might say. Or you could call it Middle Earth, for Tolkien fans. So, but there are 7 planetary systems below and 6 above. Making a total of 14. So, these are also planes or disks. Essentially, you can think of them as parallel, like phonograph records on a spindle. Yeah? Yeah. That's correct. Tomorrow I will discuss in more detail what the relation must be between this Earth that we experience as a globe and this Bhumandala structure. Now, obviously, in describing Bhumandala, I began by making a diagram of Jambudvip. Part of Jambudvip is Bharatavarsha. Now, of course, we know a Bharatavarsha, that's India. And certainly, within this Bharatavarsha, there's a place called Aryavarta, for example. Well, that's in India, and so on. So obviously there's a link up between Jambudvip and the Earth that we know. And what I will do tomorrow, I won't go into this right now, is indicate that essentially the Earth that we know must correspond to part of Bharatvarsha. So how that can be, I'll discuss tomorrow. Oh, all the various ideas about UFOs. Well, that, of course, is a very controverted topic and convoluted also. Yeah, it's a whole subject. Of course, people see all kinds of strange things flying about in the sky from time to time. And there are different categories of observations. Probably there are some entities flying around that may correspond to craft piloted by intelligent beings. At least it's not unreasonable to think that that might be true. It's hard to get any definite knowledge on this subject, though. Well, they don't. In this write-up I have here, there's a whole section on space travel, because that's not naturally a topic we'll want to discuss when considering the Vedic model of the universe. I'll see if I'll have a chance to get to that tomorrow. Actually, it's quite interesting. Srila Prabhupada makes quite a number of comments about space travel. It's indeed true that the demigods don't come here in Kali Yuga. This earth is placed under quarantine in Kali Yuga. Quite explicitly so. It's a definite policy on the part of the universal government. But there are other kinds of beings that can go flying around. Many different forms of living beings are described in the Vedic literature. Well, yeah, there. For example, eight, let's see, what is it? 100 yojanas up above the plain of Bhumandala, there is the region of the yakshas, rakshasas, pisachas, and so forth. So it's described there as an inhabited region, which is in what looks to us like outer space, and which is inhabited by different kinds of beings, which are essentially demoniac and have very great mystical powers. So that is described. All of these things are, of course, quite mind-blowing by the standard of the modern scientific education. Other questions? Yeah? Well, it's a fact that Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto are not mentioned, as far as I'm aware. Of course, Shukadev Goswami pointed out in the Bhagavatam, and I cited that verse in the beginning, that it would be impossible to describe everything within the universe. So he was just giving some salient features. So if certain things are left out, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're declared to be non-existent in the Vedic literatures. So I don't know why they're left out, but in fact they're not mentioned. Well, I don't know how astrologers arrive at ideas concerning what their influences are. I know astrologers assign influences to these planets, but how do they know? For example, in the time since Pluto has been discovered, it hasn't made a complete orbit yet. So how do they know what its influences are in the different signs of the zodiac? Anyway, that's another topic. No, it doesn't, as far as I'm aware. Yeah? But I haven't seen that report. Well, I recently saw a report that some Russian cosmonaut saw angels up there. Of course, one of the first Russian cosmonauts made a point of saying that he went up in outer space and he didn't see God. So perhaps this cosmonaut was trying to adjust the balance there. I don't know. Of course, it's hard to know how much validity there is in all of these different statements. But yeah. No, the Bhagavatam doesn't mention the planet Pluto. Can you find a... Well, okay, I should point out to you then, I know that purport. Srila Prabhupada is not referring to the planet Pluto, he's referring to Greek mythology. You see, Pluto is the lord of death in Greek mythology. He's referring to the netherworld. Yamaraj corresponds to Pluto in terms of his function as a demigod. In Greek mythology, Pluto is the judge of the dead and so forth, just as Yamaraj is. So when you speak of the Plutonic realm, it's not a reference to the planet Pluto. Yeah. According to the interpretation I'm giving here, the gross movement is mainly due to the Kala Chakra, in which everything is sweeping around due to the total rotation of the whole system. However, the stars will be gaining slightly on the sun because the sun is moving the other way with respect to the stars. And that means if you took a flash photo or a photo at the same time each day of the sun, then you'd be seeing it moving to the east. And that would be due to the motion of the sun's chariot around Manasotara, according to the idea that I'm presenting. Yeah? It's not quite perpendicular, but it comes fairly close to it, because we do see the sun going way up in the sky and coming down. So that means the plane of Bhumandala doesn't correspond to our local horizon. Of course, if the Earth is like a globe and it did correspond to our local horizon at one place, then if you went south or north, then it wouldn't correspond to the local horizon. In fact, at a certain point up north, it will correspond, indeed, because it's tilted. In fact, it corresponds along the Arctic Circle, to be exact, because that's 23.5 degrees, and the tilt is 23.5 degrees. Yeah? As far as I'm aware, basically, in the Bhagavatam, the descriptions of the daily and yearly motion of the sun are both given relative to Mount Meru and to the Bhumandala. However, in order to make a consistent picture of everything, if one takes the wheel described by Sukadeva Goswami as corresponding to Bhumandala and the rotation of the wheel as being due to the rotation of the chakra, that is the daily rotation, and then the movement of the sun around the wheel as corresponding to the movement of the ant in his analogy, then you do find that everything makes sense in terms of what we see. And as I said, in fact, we see this Bhagavatam commentator Vamsidhar is referring to Bhumandala as corresponding to Nakshatra Kaksha. Well, Of course, there's no rigid axle. I mean, you just have space. But the idea is that the axis of the universe runs from Mount Meru through the pole star. Oh, well, there the idea is that just like in the oil press, at least from what I understand, I've never seen one of these things, but the idea is you have a wheel and an axle that goes to a central post, and as the wheel goes around, that axle is rotating around and it's hinged to the central post. So it just keeps going all the way around. Yeah, you do. That means that axle is going to go around once a day. And it's going to be shifting up and down as it goes around, if you think about what's happening. Actually, it's described that in addition to the axle that goes from the wheel of the chariot to Mount Meru, there's an additional axle that goes in the direction of the pole star part way. And then it says that axle is connected to the pole star by a rope of wind. And it's described that in the course of a year, that rope of wind shortens and elongates. It spends one half of the year shortening and one half of the year elongating. And if you consider that the sun is moving on a plane tilted at a 23-degree angle and is moving in a circle on that plane, some of the time it's getting closer, and say the pole star is way up here on this axis. As it's going this way on the plane in the direction of the tilt towards the pole star, the distance to the pole star will be shrinking until it reaches the highest point, which is the summer solstice. And then as it keeps going on the plane, that axis will be, distance from the pole star will be increasing until it goes down and reaches the lower point, which is the winter solstice, and so forth. Yeah, that describes the shortening and the lengthening of the wind of the rope of wind connecting the chariot to the pole star. So that also works consistently according to that idea. Yeah? Well, of course, when I describe the stars as being attached to the celestial sphere, that's imaginary. That's just an image to help convey the idea of the rotation of all the stars in unison. It's as though they were attached to a sphere. Now, the Vedic description of the motion of the stars is that by the power of the Kala Chakra, there is a wind which is called the Pravaha wind, which is rotating clockwise. And everything within the universe is swept around by this wind in unison. So, of course, one might initially think that that is a very naive description of things, but a few points can be made to clarify it. The first point is that this wind is not a wind of ordinary air, because it is also described in the Bhagavatam that less than 100 miles up, you come to the end of ordinary air. Less than 100 yojanas up, I mean. So the idea that the atmosphere has a highest limit is there in the Bhagavatam. It's described that there's an upper limit to the clouds and to the region in which birds can fly. And beyond that, you come to what is called antariksha, and there's no more air, that is breathable air of the kind we have here on the earth. So in fact, that corresponds to the modern conception of the atmosphere. So beyond that, there's no more air of the kind that we can breathe. However, there is air, according to the Bhagavatam. It's a different kind of air. In fact, that also agrees with the modern scientific conception, because according to modern scientific ideas, the atmosphere of the sun actually extends well beyond the orbit of the earth, and there's something called the solar wind. So there's air out there, but it's not breathable. And it's in the form of what is called a plasma, a very thin plasma. While I'm not, I don't want to argue that the Bhagavatam is describing exactly what the scientists are describing, that's not my point. But the point is that according to the Bhagavatam, there is air out there which is different from the air that we can breathe. And there is a wind within that volume of air which is sweeping around in a rotary motion around the axis from Mount Meru to the pole star. So the way to imagine that is that this entire mass of air is rotating around that axis. Now, what that means is that there's no relative motion between the different parts of that air. So that means if you were moving with the air, you wouldn't feel anything. It's just like you might have experience sometimes if there's a fairly light wind, you can walk at the same speed as the wind if you walk in the same direction, and then you don't feel anything. The air feels perfectly still. But if you turn around and walk in the opposite direction, then you feel a wind. And likewise, Srila Prabhupada has used this as an illustration of how Maya can affect a person. His example is that when a cloud is moving in the sky under the influence of a strong wind, when you're on the ground, you feel the wind and you see the cloud moving overhead. So you may have the impression that really there's a lot of wind there pushing that cloud along. But from the perspective of the cloud, the air is still. The cloud doesn't feel anything because it's moving at the same speed as the air. So from the cloud's point of view, it's in still air. So similarly, a person who has fallen into Maya doesn't realize that he's being carried along by the current of Maya. He feels that he's in perfectly normal equilibrium. But actually, under the current of Maya, he's being swept along. So that example is given. So, just to finish this, the idea then is that the planets, the stars, and so on, in fact, everything that is out there is sitting in this surrounding volume of air, and they don't feel anything because they're just moving with it. They're in equilibrium, but the whole thing is rotating. So that's the description which is given. And as for the nature of stars, I'll go into that tomorrow. That's also in tomorrow's lecture. Yeah? Well, as a matter of fact, from a strictly scientific point of view, you can say that you can take anything as fixed if you like and consider everything else is moving relative to it. Now, there are a few points I could make about that concerning physics. This gets kind of interesting. Galileo introduced the principle of relative motion into physics. And he did this for rectilinear motion, that is motion in a straight line. And his example, actually it's similar to this cloud example too. His example is that if you're in the hold of a ship, and the ship is moving along at a uniform rate on perfectly smooth water, then a person inside the ship won't be able to tell that the ship is moving. It'll seem as though everything is perfectly still for him. So the idea then is that from a physical point of view, you can't tell that you're moving due to any intrinsic thing that happens to you due to the motion. You can only tell that you're moving relative to something else by seeing that something else move past. Or you can say that you're standing still and that something else is moving from the point of view of physics. So that was introduced by Galileo. But the idea that people had, though, was that accelerated motion is different. Because in accelerated motion, there is something you can detect within yourself which varies depending on how fast you're accelerating. That is, in a car, when we accelerate, we feel ourselves thrust back against the seat. Or, in the case of rotary motion, if you take a bucket of water, you can ask, is this bucket rotating or not? Well, if it's rotating, then the water will begin to move up the sides of the bucket. At least if it's rotating fairly fast, that becomes measurable. So you can say, well, if the water's moving up the sides of the bucket, it's rotating, and otherwise it isn't. So the result was, if you were standing on a merry-go-round, and in the center there was a bucket sitting there, you would be able to say that you were rotating and the bucket wasn't, because the water in the bucket was flat, but you felt a pull pulling you outward. So you'd say, well, I'm rotating and so is the merry-go-round. That's definitely happening, and the bucket is definitely not rotating. So a physicist named Ernst Mach, however, made another proposal. He suggested that actually you can have relative, you can apply the principle of relativity to rotary motion in the following way. He said the way you can look at it is that you can say that, say I have a rotating bucket here, that the bucket is standing still and the entire universe is rotating around it, and because of the motion of all that matter, it induces forces in the water that pull it out. So, in fact, in modern physics, there's the idea of what is called a gauge field theory, in which is just like that. The idea is that an accelerated motion of a large mass will induce forces in a small mass, which correspond to the idea of the forces of acceleration if the small mass was moving and the large mass was standing still. Now, okay, why am I going into all of this? The purpose for doing so, very simply, is the following. One may say it is very naive in light of modern science to think that the Earth is a stationary platform and the entire mass of the cosmos is rotating around it, because that's what the Bhagavatam is saying. However, actually, from the point of view of physics, you can adopt that viewpoint if you want. At least there are ideas in physics, such as the ideas developed by Ernst Mach, which allow for that. And then the next point is, this description of the universe given in the Bhagavatam implies that there's a lot that we don't know about physics. That's one implication that is immediately there. If what the Bhagavatam is saying is true, then there's an invisible world out there which extends for billions of miles, but we don't see it. So from the point of view of physics as we know it today, that's not possible. If there really is an Earth out there extending for so many millions of miles, then for one thing it should exert gravitational forces. You could calculate that if you have a disk of a certain thickness, say it's many thousands of miles thick, and it extends in a plate for 4 billion miles, the gravity that would produce would be tremendous, and one should be able to measure such forces and so on. And we don't detect anything like that. So one can say, well, then it must not exist. But the point then is that this description implies that there must be something more to physics than what we presently know. So the Bhagavatam very much challenges conventional views. But the basic point I was making today was it doesn't make nonsense out of our ordinary perception of what we see in the sky, which one might assume it does on a first cursory inspection. Yeah, from a physical point of view, if you like, you can have the Earth standing still and the universe rotating around it. You can take the Foucault pendulum experiment. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that. In that experiment, you set a pendulum swinging and you have it attached to a swivel, which is free to rotate with very little resistance. And you see that in the course of a day, the plane of rotation of the pendulum goes around. So it said, well, this is an indication of the rotation of the Earth. But according to Mach's ideas, you could say the universe is rotating around, and that induces forces that drag the pendulum around in its plane of rotation. So all kinds of things are possible. Yeah? Well, I just made a comment there that it's not milk as we know it, because it hasn't curdled. Well, in that case, it's different. In other words, the meaning of that comment was that people will tend to take the description of an ocean of milk as being a very naive thing. However, there's no need to look at it in that way. The conditions there can be different. It can be a different kind of milk, or if you like, it can be milk in a different kind of condition. Yes, when the milk ocean was churned, it produced various things, such as elephants that live for millions of years, and many different amazing things. Well, first it produced poison, a very deadly kind of poison which was drunk by Lord Shiva, and so on. So obviously what is happening out there is different from what happens with ordinary milk. The Bhagavatam is using ordinary language to describe these things, but obviously it's describing things that to us are extraordinary. So if Vyasadeva is going to convey these things to us, he has to use words that we can understand. What else can he do if he's going to communicate to us? So naturally he uses words that are familiar to ordinary human beings. However, one can realize that what is being described is not exactly ordinary. It follows different laws, different principles, and so forth. Yeah? Yeah? Starting point of the zodiac as being either Aries or the vernal equinox are all relative to the sphere of stars. Now that whole sphere is rotating once per day. But in thinking about the zodiac, one normally assumes that that sphere is fixed. In other words, one forgets about the daily rotation. You just imagine that it's fixed, or that you're rotating with it, in other words. And then what you think about is the movement of the sun going around through the different signs of the zodiac. So that's the description. Yeah?
According to your realization, what is the
Well, Srila Prabhupada answered that in various purports. Svetadvipa being indestructible is not destroyed. It's still there. It's a Vaikuntha planet. It doesn't go anywhere. It continues to exist in Vaikuntha because it's always in Vaikuntha, being a Vaikuntha planet. So, he has his eternal Vaikuntha planets, and they continue to exist. The universe disintegrates around them. I don't know exactly how the geometry of that works out, but that's the basic idea, that certain things continue to exist. Okay, yeah? Well, it's described that the powerhouse for that apparently is Dhruvaloka. That's the description Srila Prabhupada gives. But anyway, it is described as being due to the Kala Chakra, or the wheel of time. Ultimately, the power source is Vishnu, or Krishna. That's the idea. Yeah? Well, once again, this is just like the example of milk. when the Vedic literatures refer to sound, they're not referring to the ordinary kind of sound that, we're familiar with. Sound as we're, the sound that we're accustomed to is sound, is Vedic sound, but it is only one species of Vedic sound. Now, the Vedic understanding of sound is that sound precedes the manifestation of gross matter. Actually, sound even precedes the manifestation of ether. Sound comes before ether. So, sound is a kind of vibration, if you were, that can exist without a gross material substrate for its propagation. And not only that, it produces the gross material substrate. So, in modern physics, again, there's another illustration of this idea, which fits relatively nicely, and that is the idea of the quantum wave function. According to modern physics, gross matter is made of what you could call quantum waves. Now, a quantum wave is a completely abstract sort of thing. It's not made of anything. So you can say, if you like, that it has no material substrate. But quantum waves, by interacting with one another, and so to speak, turning in on themselves, manifest atoms, according to modern physics. And atoms are the building blocks of gross matter. So in modern physics, you have the idea of a kind of wave that is not a vibration in matter, but it actually creates matter. Well, that's the Vedic idea of sound creating ether and then subsequently all of the other elements. So the Vedic sound is different from our ordinary idea of sound. Yeah? As far as I'm aware, electromagnetic radiation fits into the description of the fire element. So there are four, the elements, the gross elements in the Vedic description are ether, air, fire, water, and earth. Okay? So electromagnetic phenomena occur on the level of fire, which also translates as effulgence, radiance, and so on, and is associated with a sense of vision, and is also associated with electricity and magnetism. Srila Prabhupada states that in different purports, actually. Electricity and electrical-type phenomena are connected with the fire element. Well, if you have a radio, otherwise you can't hear radio waves. You have to have a transducer that translates from the radio waves to the kind of sound we can hear, and that's a radio. But otherwise you can't perceive radio waves. So, let's see. Well, it's getting, yes, it's definitely getting late. I guess we can stop here. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.